Okay. So I have some answers. Should I wait for you?
No, you start.
You're not coming back?
I have something
about. Okay. That was on the record. Okay, so I have some answers for you. I think that even the one that I don't have an answer to officially, it might be incorporated in another answer. Okay, so some of the questions that we asked was, at what point and why was Birchas Kohanim stopped being done daily? And so I was like, okay, I've had all these questions, and I'm like, okay, who do I know that's like a real sitter personality, somebody that knows all the answers? And I was trying to think of who I could call, and I couldn't think of somebody, so I figured, okay, I'll just Google it. And believe it or not, there's lots of things out there. It's amazing what you can find out there, you know? I'm like, so there's somebody, his name is Rabbi Hassan, who is a Sephardi Rav in Seattle, I believe is what he says he's out of. And he had he was posed that question. It was, I guess it was like some kind of Ask the Rabbi site. So he has the same thing. So he said, basically, according to the Ashkenazim, there was somebody, a rabbi who was referred to as the Agur, Yaakov Baruch Ben Yehuda Landau, who lived in Germany, he was a German-Italian rabbi, and he said that it was the custom to immerse in the mikvah prior to doing Berchas Kohanim, which was very challenging to do in the winter in Eastern Europe because of the weather. So because they couldn't immerse in the mikvah prior, they stopped doing it every day. Rabbi Yosef Cairo, who is the author of the Shulchan Aruch, said that makes no sense. He was a Sephardi, actually, and he says that's illogical because the Torah doesn't command them to immerse in the mikvah before they give the bracha. So they wouldn't have to, so they should have just given the bracha. Another answer that's given is by the Rama, who is a Perush on the Halacha. He said, the reason that he says is because, as we mentioned, that Birchas Kohanim had to be done with simcha. It had to be done with happiness. And we said also that even on during the day, people are distracted and people are worried and they're rushing here and rushing there. And even on Shabbos, we're somewhat distracted. So the problem was that in the 1500s, the Ashkenazi Jews in Germany, it was a very challenging time. They were very poor. There was a lot of anti-Semitism. They were always on the run. They never knew if this was going to be their last day or not. So they stopped it because there was no simcha on a daily basis. And they just instituted it only on Yom Tov. And then we said that another reason why it was discontinued was because it had been discontinued, and the two rabbis that we discussed yesterday that tried to start it again, and the calamities that happened when they started, so they just left it as is. It wasn't changed. Except that the Talmidim of the Gra, that was the rabbi who tried, the Vilna Gaon, who tried to reinstitute it, who was actually imprisoned the day that he was planning on reinstituting it, his Talmidim, the Talmidim of the Gra, actually made like a group aliyah to Israel. And there's a section in Israel, you know, Talmidei HaGra, and they follow certain minhagim, they have their own customs, and it is their custom, actually, to say Berchat Kohanim every day, wherever they are. Then we have also the Sephardim, though. The Sephardim were split on this. There are some Sephardim who do say it every day, some Sephardim who don't. In Izmir, Turkey, the Torah was read only on the Birchas Kohanim was done only on Torah reading days. In places such as Italy, Amsterdam, and Algeria, it was read on Shabbos only. So the question then is why? Like, why are some Sephardim do and some Sephardim don't? Because very often it was because of the influence of the Ashkenazim. They did what the Ashkenazim did. They were influenced by them. Also, the Sephardim also found that they didn't always have a minyan. They didn't always have the quorum of men that was necessary. The people were more assimilated in the Sephardi lands than in the Ashkenazi lands. And there were also people that didn't know how. Because they were more assimilated, they didn't know how to do Berachas Kohanim. They didn't do it all the time. And here's another reason, which is fascinating. Shabtai Tzvi, who was a false messiah, and one of the things that he instituted was, and he was very big on, and one of his big teachings was about Birkat Kohanim. So after he was discovered to be a fraud, everybody was afraid of him and all of his teachings and rulings, so they went far away from anything that he said. So they discontinued it. so that there wouldn't be any reference or prominence to Shabtai Tzvi. Okay, so that I thought was very interesting. And then also the paragraph about the dreams. Okay, so the paragraph about the dreams, this is from Judaism Stack Exchange. So basically it does say in the Gemara, it quotes the Gemara in Brachos 55b, that says that if somebody has a dream and doesn't remember it, or if they're concerned about their dream, they should stand before the Kohanim when the Kohanim was saying Berchas Kohanim. So it's actually brought down in the Gemara that this is something that one does. And, you know, what is the connection then between dreams and why one should go to the Kohen specifically at the time when he's doing Berchas Kohanim? So that Noam Elimelech says that dreams are 1/60th of a nevuah. So it's like a low, 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 low level of prophecy. Kohanim, when they do Berchas Kohanim, it's prophecy. So there's an expression, like when it comes to kosher, batel b'shishim, like if you have a huge pot of chicken soup and some milk falls into it, it doesn't automatically make a treif. It depends on the number. So if the 60 times more chicken soup than the milk that fell into it, then your pot is still kosher and your chicken soup is still fleishig. So the same thing, it's batel b'shishim. If this person had a dream and he's nervous, the dream is 1/60th of a prophecy. The Kohanim is total prophecy, so it swallows up and it absorbs the dream and it's nullified. And it's nothing to be afraid of anymore. The number 60 is actually an important number. There's a paragraph from Shir HaShirim, which we say before we go to sleep at night also, it's in Kriya Shema Shel Hamita, about Hinei Mitaso Shel Shlomo, behold is the bed of Shlomo, Shishim Giborim Savivlo, he had 60 guards around him, Pachad Laila, from the fear of night. So a Pachad Laila, something that fears you, is a nightmare, a dream, a bad dream. And then there are 60 letters in the words of Berchas Kohanim to correspond to the 60 protections that we have. So Berchas Kohanim is like a protection for our dreams, for what we think of at night. So that would explain why we could say this paragraph versus the other psukim, because this paragraph is actually brought down in the Gemara that we should say it. So, but we all agree that when we say it, it shouldn't be the actual dream at the same time that the Kohanim are actually talking. We could do it in between paragraphs or when they're doing their singing. The question as to why then those other verses that are there, why are they there if we can say them? I don't have an answer yet for that. I'm still working on that. But this would also explain the connection. And I think we still had the question of why the third paragraph is changed. Still working on that one. But this would explain, I think somebody asked, would we say this paragraph any other time? I don't think so. Right? You would save it up, you know, for when it's time for Berchas Kohanim. Okay? So that, I found that really very interesting also, and the practicalities of it.
So when we do the Berchas Kohanim now, I mean, it's a Torah mitzvah, it's like, it's in the Torah that the Kohanim should do the blessing, but the what they're doing now, is that considered to be, like, to Rabbanan, that they should do it in the services in that way? Because I'm thinking, like, if it's a Torah mitzvah, how can people decide, oh, we're not doing it now, or we're only going to do it sometimes, or whatever, or the mitzvah is that the Kohanim should bless, but, that's in the context of the temple service, and therefore, to do it any time out of the temple service, it's really up to us to determine when and how often, and you see what I'm saying?
I'm thinking. I'm listening. So I'm just... The mitzvah is still de'oraisa. It's a given by Torah law, right? We saw that inside. The question as to how to fulfill it properly, I guess that was decided on by the rabbis to make it practical and to make sure that it's done correctly. Because of the intricate laws involved of being besimcha and happiness and doing it with ahava, with love. So we say that a Kohen who is in a quarrel with members of the synagogue should not get up there and say Berachas Kohanim, because he's not be ahava. He's in an argument, he's in a dispute. So I guess in terms of the practicalities and to safeguard the mitzvah, maybe that would be more of like a siyag l'Torah, of how the Rabbanim said, okay, you know what, our circumstances have changed. We're like in a state of constant fear. You don't have the presence of mind to be saying it now, so you can't. Right? You're not going to be fulfilling the mitzvah properly. You'd be doing it wrong. I don't know if that answers your question.
I mean, don't say, oh, if you
Right. Well, there's no, I mean, the mitzvah of davening is the connection of Hashem. It doesn't say we have to daven v'simcha. It doesn't say only if you're, you know, slowly. Like, I think that the difference is that there are specific laws. It has to be done slow. It has to be done happy. It has to be, you know, like, I think all, in order to fulfill all the requirements, right? I think when we daven, even if we're not davening wholeheartedly or all of it wholeheartedly, we're still getting that connection. Something is still going through. But I think that I'm this is mine, I could still look into it further, that it wouldn't be going through if we don't have, you know, if we don't follow the, you know, like the transmissions, right? You know, like it could be, you know, like they always use the example of like a telephone number. You're one number off and you're not going to get the right person. So like we could punch in, when you could punch in all, you know, everything, but then you take away simcha, then it's not happening. You take away slowly, it's not happening. You're losing that. So there are times also when there are mitzvahs that don't apply now or are not done now because we can't fulfill them properly. Some are done anyways because even if they're not the best way, it's a preparation. And that, I guess, was also like the Rabbanim deciding, you know, what's appropriate at which time and not. You know, that was not, again, that's not something that we could decide, oh, today, I'm not so up to doing X, Y, or Z. I mean, we can, but not as a blanket uniform. Okay, so I think today now we're up to the concept of Kohanim. Let's talk a little bit about the Kohanim. We're going to try to put some of the odds and ends together. We'll try to bring it all into one package now. So some of the things that we've discussed were the Kohuna was started with Aaron HaKohen. Aaron HaKohen was worthy of wearing the choshen, of wearing the breastplate, because of his internal happiness for Moshe, even though Moshe was his younger brother and he received greatness greater than him. And he went out to greet Moshe with a complete happiness. And we are going to now discuss then the role of that choshen and what that does for the Kohanim. So I guess part of the discussion for today will be, does clothing make the man or does man make the clothing? Because we'll talk a little bit about the Big Day Kahuna and the role of the Kohanim's clothes. And then also we also touched base on comparing the Nazir to the Kohen. We said that the reason why Nazir and Kahuna, Birchas Kohanim, were next to each other is because just as a Nazir is holy, so too a Kohen is holy. And one of the things that they do, both of them do, to ensure their holiness is to refrain from coming in contact with a mace, with a person who has passed away or with a funeral. And we are actually going to see that there is actually a difference in the halacha between a nazir and being tamei lemace and a kohen, and why.
As you're talking, it just struck me. You know the expression "here's the big kahuna"?
I think it's from that.
It must be. Maybe I'm sort of behind the times, right? Just realizing it now.
Yeah. I've seen before, like I've seen like little articles that have
big kahuna.
Yeah.
So it's interesting.
It could be. It had, like, there are other expressions that, you know, I don't know if they're a spin-off of the Hebrew or the, you know, the Chazal, but yeah. Okay, so we're in the booklet that, my pages are all mixed up, so forget about organizing. But I think that the cover of the booklet looks like this. It says Sherei Aaron, and it says Kuf Yud on the top right corner. Is that your first page? Might flip that one over. Oh, yeah. No, not that one. I think that one we did yesterday. It might be that one, but the other side of it. Flip it. Flip the whole booklet. That's it. Okay, we have it? Okay, so some of this we did already, so I don't want to do the part that we did inside, but I do need to refer to it to bring it back together. So we said that Aaron merited to wear the choshen because of his behavior, and we also talked about how Aaron was disappointed that his behavior, he would have pushed himself to do even more had he known that we were going to be reading this centuries later. So what I want to look at, what we haven't actually done inside yet, is the third paragraph or the third bulleted paragraph on the left-hand column, where it says Vikasav. Okay, so it says Vikasav Ha'abar Benel. This is from the Sha'arei Aharon, the one that I told you was like the, you know, brief synopsis of many, many commentaries. So he's quoting the Ha'abar Benel that says Hamaymar Zeh Tzarech Bior. This concept of Aharon meriting to wear the Choshen because of his happiness needs some explanation. Madua nisya ches hagimol hazeh la'aron al tov levavo benevuas Moshe Rabbeinu alav hashalom. Why is there a connection of this payback of Aharon being happy in his heart for Moshe's prophecy? Yoser mikol midos tovosha hayulo. Why this characteristic of his more than any other characteristic that Aharon had? Ve'eich yachasu choshen hamishpat lischar hazeh. And how could they possibly have connected the reward of the choshen to this action? Ki halohu haya miches bigdei kohen gadol. Wasn't the choshen one of the eight special garments that the Kohen Gadol wore? V'imkein, and if so, if it was part of the priestly garments, zacha alav begin kahuna so. If so, he deserved those garments because he was the Kohen, lo bischar simchas libo. Not because he was happy. So you hear that? Like, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Did he inherit the clothes because he was a Kohen? And that's what the Kohen wore? Or is he inheriting it because he was happy and that's why he's a Kohen and that's why he wore it? Because of Haran. So the Ran says, Shebechol midosav shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu mida keneged mida. Every characteristic, every way that Hashem acts and measures out is mida keneged mida, measure for measure, action for action. Everything relates. It's exactly equal. The crime fits the punishment, the reward fits the positive. Ki zehu hamevi b'nei adam leha'amin b'pinas ha'hashkacha. This is what causes a person to trust and to believe in the guidance and the watching of Hashem. V'yadua she'choshen lo hayamagid ha'asidos. The choshen did not tell the future. Ki im mitzar ha'urim v'hatumim shahayubo. The Urim v'Tumim was a special parchment that was placed inside the Choshen, and that's what gave the power of the Nevuah, of the prophecy. The Choshen on its own had no power of prophecy. V'ha'urim v'ha'tumim lo hayu michlal ha'bigadim. So the Urim v'Tumim that gave this power of prophecy and vision to the Kohen Gadol was not one of the eight that are included in the special clothings of the Kohen Gadol. Shaharei b'vayisheni hayubo choshen v'lo hayubo urim v'tumim. In the time of the second Beis Hamikdash, there were some of the vessels that were missing. And one of the things that were missing was the urim v'tumim. The parchment was not there, but the choshen was. V'lachein timsa Sheha'urim v'hatumim lo nizkaru b'seder pikudei b'maisei ha'pikudim. So we'll find that when in the Torah, when it lists the vessels and it lists the garments, urim v'tumim is not mentioned because that's separate. Kehine kasuv v'yaseh ha'efod v'yaseh ha'choshen. It says in the pasuk they made the ephod, the apron, they made the choshen. Lo amar v'yaseh ha'urim v'hatumim. It never says anywhere that the urim v'tumim was made. This was not crafted by the crafters, by those who made the vessels, Betzalel and Ahaliyah and their group of people. Moshe was the only one who was commanded about this concept. We could go back to Parshas Tetzaveh and see that there. What does it say? V'nasata el choshen ha-mishpat es ha-urim ve-es ha-tumim. And you should put into the choshen the urim ve-tumim. V'chol zeh morel lanu, and this all comes to teach us, shelo hayu ha-urim ve-ha-tumim miklal bigdei kahuna. So the urim ve-tumim was not part of the clothing of the Kohen Gadol. V'ro'oi im kein lish'ol. So then we could still ask, Lama zacha bahem Aaron ha-kohen. So then why did Aaron merit this? Ki kimo shehanavi begin shehu navi. Just as a navi, on the very premise that he is a prophet, tiyuchas alav hagadas ha'asidos velo avodas ha-mikdash. A navi is able to see the future, but he doesn't do service in the temple. Kach ha-kohen begin shehu kohen. Ruuya elav haboda bamikdash v'lo hagadas ha'asidos. A kohen's job, just like a navi's job, is to do prophecy and not to do service. The kohen's job was to do service and not to do prophecy. Lekach amar Rabbi Shamlai shezacha Aaron lezeh b'schus v'ra'acha v'samach b'libo. So what did Aaron merit? He merited the prophecy of the Urim v'Tumim that went into the Choshen, which was not one of the parts of the clothing of the Kohen Gadol. Klomar, meaning to say, Shalom is kanei leMoshe Rabbeinu alav hashalom, because he did not get jealous of Moshe, Achiv hakatan mimenu, his younger brother, Begadlus hanevua, because of his greatness in prophecy, Gamni balifanav b'Mitzrayim, he also had prophecy before him when they were in Mitzrayim. B'lachein hayasticharo, therefore his reward was shezacha lehagadas ha'asidos be'orim b'tumim. So he, not that he got the choshen as a reward, because the choshen, you're right, the choshen he got because he was a kohen gadol. All kohen gadols got the choshen. That's what they wore. But the part that was added on to Aaron was the Urim B'Tumim, which gave power to the Choshen. And that was not existent in all time periods. It was only existent in the Beis HaMikdash, in the Mishkan, and it implies that it was there during the first Beis HaMikdash, but in the second Beis HaMikdash it wasn't there. And that, therefore, is the connection of Aaron getting something that's worn on his heart, that's in addition to, or that's more personal than an addition to what all the other Kohanim would get. So now if we continue on the next page, page 118, the Rabbeinu Bachai, he tells us, Lekavod u'letiferes, for honor and for glory, that the Kohanim had to wear these clothes for honor and glory. So we're going to see here whose honor and whose glory was it talking about. For who? For whose benefit? So if we're looking over there, there should be a bullet there. On 118, Chaf Ches Beis, Lekavod u'letiferes. We'll do parts of it inside, and parts of it are just more explanation, so in the interest of time, we'll skip around a little bit. So what does it say? Al derech hapshat, sheyischabed v'yispa'er bahem. So according to the simple reason, Lekavod u'letiferes, the Kohen Gadol wore these clothes for honor and glory, that he should be lefi, shehakohen hagadol, malach Hashem tzivakos, Eitzel ha-yechidim be'inyan ha-avoda, because the Kohen Gadol is like the angel of God, because he is the representative of Hashem, he is the one doing all of the service. Yitzave ata lahalbisho bigdei malchus liyoso melech nichbad u'mifawar eitzel ha-hamon, because he is the representative of God, he is the one doing the service, he should be wearing honorable and respectable clothes that are beautiful and that are gorgeous, so everyone recognizes him and sees the status of such, that he has a very important role to play. And then it describes that a little bit more, and it talks about all of the people who had beautiful clothes. It tells us that in the time of Shmuel, the women of the king would dress in special clothes. It tells us that Yosef wore special clothes. Like, all of these special clothes distinguish the person as their role and as their role as a role model. It talks about the different clothing that the person wears. But then if we look down a little bit further down, it tells us that, I'm just trying to find the actual place where it says it. Here we go. I can't find the place right now, but in this paragraph also we're talking about that it's not for the kavod of teferes of the Kohen, but the kavod and teferes of Hashem. So he's wearing the clothes, and either it, both ways it brings honor to Hashem, but in one way it's honor for him as a representative of Hashem, and in one way it's to show that he is, that as the respect to Hashem, it brings honor and glory to Hashem in his service. I'm just trying to, I lost my place here, I can't find it right now. Okay, so what we actually need to continue then is about the clothing, and that is over here. That if we flip a few pages, I think 1, 2, 3, past the English, right? The English says Parshas Emor, there's 2 pages of English. On the back of the 2nd page of English, there's a Chidush HaLev that says Ayin Vav, and there's a bullet over there. We have that? Okay. So we're also, again, we're talking about the clothing make the man, or the man makes the clothing. Why Aaron was wearing these special clothing, and what clothes does for a person. So let's take this a step further. We're going to see that anything that we can learn from our avos, from the forefathers, from the Ishei HaTanakh, the personalities in the Torah, can be used as a lesson for us, and let's see how that can apply to us. So it tells us in Vayikra, Kisones Bar Kodesh Yilbash. It's talking about the special big day kahuna that the Kohen should wear. So Rashi says, Kisones Bar, the white linen clothes, this is talking about on Yom Kippur, Magid She'eno Mishamesh Lifnim Bishmona Bigadim Shehu Mishamesh Bahen Bachut She'yesh Bahem Zahav. Bafnim U'bachut, inside and outside. There were 2 places where the Kohen Gadol to perform his service. 364, or I guess 354, if you're going according to the Jewish calendar, 354 days of the year, the Kohen performed his service outside, meaning in the Kodesh, in the holy area, in the Chatzer, in the courtyard. There was only 1 day a year when he was Bifnim, when he was inside, in the Kodesh Kedashim, in the Holies of Holies. So on that day, on Yom Kippur, in the Holy of Holies, he was not allowed to wear any of his garments that contained gold. And it says, Lefi she'ein kategar na'aseh sanegar, because a prosecutor cannot become a defense attorney. Ela be'arba'a kekohen hedyot v'chulan shelbot. Rather, he should just wear the 4 basic garments, just like the ordinary Kohanim, the other ones wear, that are made entirely of white linen. So what is this concept of a prosecutor becoming a defense? So when you have a case, there's the prosecution, the one who gets up there and wants to vilify the person at the stand and say what they did wrong and why they were wrong and find all kinds of ways to make them guilty. The defender, the defense attorney, will get up there and explain why it wasn't their client, why they weren't really there, why it wasn't their fault, and use all kinds of methods and arguments to get them out of it. Now, gold is an object. Gold is not actually a person. It doesn't have any physical, you know, human qualities. However, there was a significant incident that happened with gold, and that was the Chet HaEgel. So the Chet HaEgel, the sin of the golden calf, happened with gold. Aaron was involved to some extent with this incident, which it's a whole nother, you know, whole nother topic. Not for right now. We'll just skim the surface right now. Aaron was involved with this, and therefore, gold for him can be seen as a prosecution. It could be seen as something that can be taken against him. Therefore, when on Yom Kippur, he's going into the Kodesh Kedashim, he's going into the Holies of Holies, and he's trying to defend the Jewish people, gain forgiveness and peace for the Jewish people, and grant that Hashem should grant them a positive year. We don't want to evoke something which might remind or reference something which was not good, a hard time or a prosecution time. So a prosecutor can come as a defense. You can't use both. Like, you can't have gold for the glory and use it as, this is a glorious day, let's have a glorious year, and at the same time not reminisce the fact that gold was used for something that caused the destruction to the Jewish people. O Medrash Rabbah. So the Medrash explains on this. Rabbi Simon b'shem Rabbi Yoshua Amar. Mipnei ma ein Kohen Gadol nechnas bevigdei zahav? Why doesn't the Kohen Gadol enter with the golden clothes? Ela ein kategar nasa sanegar. It's going back on the words that the Rashi said, that this prosecutor can't come with the defense. Kadei shalolei tein pischon pet lesatan lekatreg vilomar. We don't want to give the Satan, which the prosecuting angel, the evil inclination, an opportunity to start a conversation or to have an in and to say, Esmol asu lahem Elohei Zahav, v'hayom hei mevakshim l'shamesh bevigdei Zahav. Yesterday they wanted to use the gold to go against you. Today they're using the gold to go with you. Rabbi Yoshua desachnin b'shem Rabbi Levi Amar. So different rabbi said, b'shvil lachus al memonan shel Yisrael. So one rabbi says, he doesn't go in with the golden clothes on Yom Kippur because we're worried and we care about the possessions of the Jewish people. Rabbi Levi Amar, Rabbi Levi says, mipnei ha-gaiva al sham al tishader lifnei melech. Another rabbi says, because there's a certain level of haughtiness when a person is wearing these fancy clothes. For Rabbeinu Yonah b'perusho al ha-Torah, sasam kemo Rabbi Levi. Rabbi Yonah is so same the words of Rabbi Levi, and he says, lahazhir kohen gadol, to warn the kohen gadol, shelo yishane b'davar b'chol ha-avodo sheyesh lo la'asos b'yoso b'yichud lifnai u'lifnim. To warn the Kohen Gadol that he is not allowed to change anything at all in his avoda, in his service, to differentiate it from when he's within, then from when he's out. Gvigam, and also, Sheyavosham be'ema ubi'yira beretas ubi'zeya. That when he goes into that Holy of Holies, he goes into the Kodesh Kedoshim, it's the holiest place on the holiest day of the year, he should enter it with a fear and awe and respect. Velo yagis daito b'hiyoso nivchar mikol Yisrael la'avoda hahi. So that he shouldn't have his heart, libo gaspo, that his heart should not be elevated, that he should not feel a pride, I was the one that was chosen by the Jewish people to do this. So we have to step him down so that he's not wearing these luxurious clothes that symbolize his luxurious position. V'razal amru, ki mipnei zeh haya oved avodos bipnim bevigdei lavan. This is why he had to go in with his white clothes. V'haya poshet bigdei zahav me'alav. He had to take off his gold clothes. Mishum dechsiv al tishader lifnei melech. Do not glorify yourself before the king. So we're actually having a compare and contrast from what we said before. On a daily basis, likavod ulitiferes. He is supposed to be proud and dignified and kingly and godly representative. That's on a daily basis, but not on Yom Kippur, and not in the Kodesh Kedoshim.
He's godly, he's a representative to the people. When he goes to Hashem, he has a different name, he has a different face, different dress.
Right. Okay, so let's compare that also. We're gonna get
he's
to that.
He's not asking for forgiveness on a daily basis, right?
What's that?
He's not there representing them in terms of asking for forgiveness on a daily
basis. Well, the karbanos were, like karban chatos, they were used as a forgiveness, but there was much more riding on Yom Kippur, obviously, than on the daily basis. So on the daily basis, there had to be that imagery.
That's like the specific sins that have been, like, is that individuals bringing the karbanos for their specific sins?
Both.
Ones too.
Both.
But that's more like for the things, like,
specifically?
You know, I guess, like, specific things, whereas, like, Yom Kippur, it's kind of, like, more like
globally. Right. So I think let's say a carbon chatos that was brought on behalf of the people on certain days of the year was, I guess, also globally. But this is, it's more global. Like, Yom Kippur is for everything, right? Whereas this might would be like.
Aren't the carbon chatos like the unintentional sins?
I don't have the answer for that right now. I'd have to look that up. Right, but then there are different Would they be intentional sins versus on purpose? Write it down. Let me double check on that.
Yeah. It also reminds me of, you know, that everyone is buried the same in the same white shroud, and there's no difference. So that Yom Kippur is sort of a judgment, and it's sort of everyone's equal.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Similar idea. Okay. Okay, so that's what, it just repeats it again because he's quoting another Gemara that says the same thing. Let's go to paragraph 2. Hine Amar Rabbi Levi. Rabbi Levi says, Shahata'am, that the reason, Sha'asur Lekoin Hagadol, Lobosh Bigdei Zahav, Bisha'ashahu Nechnas El Kodesh Kedashim, who, he says that the reason why it's Asur for the Kohen Gadol to go into the Kodesh Kedashim, wearing gold on that day, Kadesha Lo Yiska'eh, that he shouldn't be boasty and proud, Kasav Rabbeinu Yonah, Rabbeinu Yonah comments on that, Sheyesh Lachush, it's possible to suspect, Shema Yiska'eh, Mishum Shehu Nivchar Mikol B'nei Yisrael La'asos Ha'avodah, that he would be haughty because he is the one who was chosen from all the Jewish people to do the avoda. U'dvariv Srichim Bior, we need to discuss this further. We need to explain that. Im hu miska'eh mishum shehu nivchar mikol b'nei adam, b'nei Yisrael, eich zeh yimana mipnei shelavesh bigdei lavan. If he's proud of himself because he's been chosen as the representative of the Jewish people, what's the difference what he's wearing? If you're proud, if you're wearing your hair up, your hair down, you're wearing a hat, you're wearing a skirt, what's the difference? If you're proud, you're proud. Why does it matter what you're wearing? Right? Is it different if he's wearing the tzitz? Is it different if he's wearing the ephod? What's the difference? Sherak im yolvash bigdei zahav, az yesh lachush shama yiska'eh? Only if he's wearing the golden clothes, that's the only time when we think that he might be proud. Ba'avor shehu nivchar mikol b'nei Yisrael. That's the only when. You can only feel proud if you're wearing gold, and if he was wearing silver or not. Shelavishas bigdei zahav, tigrom lo lahargish gaiva v'tis overrulim so tamlis goes. That it's the fact that he's wearing gold that's going to cause these feelings to erupt inside of him and start up inside of him. Chiddush gadol lamadnu kan. We learn a very great lesson, a new profound lesson we learn from here. Shafilu hakohen hagadol. That even a kohen gadol, biyom hakipurim, and even on Yom Kippur, even when he is in the Kodesh Kedashim, alul lahargish gaiva bilibo. Even a Kohen Gadol, even on Yom Kippur, even in the Kodesh Kedashim, it's possible for him to feel haughty and proud. Va'af shehu omeid lifnei melech malchei hamlachim hakadosh baruch hu. Even the fact that he's standing in front of God. Shekol hakesef v'hazahav shelo. God owns all the gold and all the silver. Bechol zos aluhu lahargish rikshei gaiva. Despite all that, knowing that he's standing before God and God owns the silver and the gold, he might still feel like that. V'hakol mishum shehu lavush bigdei zahav. And yes, that's sparked by his wearing the gold. Lilamdenu sha'afilu adam hashalim. To teach us that even a person who is complete, who has, to what in our eyes has seemingly reached perfection, we've talked about, you know, reaching perfection, mushpa me'od mimalbusho sav. Even a person who has reached perfection can indeed be transformed and influenced by what they're wearing. Let's see another example. Ke'inyan zeh matzinu etzel Chananya, Mishael, and Azariah. Hananya, Mishael, and Azariah, three Nevi'im that were thrown into a pit for believing in Hashem. Tana Devei Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov. So this is the Gemara talking. Afilu b'shas hasakana, even in a time of danger, lo yishane adam es atzmo min harabanus shelo. A person should not take himself away from his stature. Shene'emar, as it says, and it's from Daniel, Be'adin Gavra Eilech, which is Aramaic because it's in Daniel. And what does he say? Here. Ve'od nir'eh, it's ta'am zeh, this means to say, Shelo yir'eh ha'adam es atzmo mitza'er u'misabel al din shamayim. A person should not show off himself as being in anguish and in mourning about the din, which would be like a harsh decree from Shemayim, avo yekablu ba'ava uvesimcha derech kavod. Rather, they should accept it with, this is obviously a high level, of being able to accept every crisis or every harsh decree or hard situation with love and with simcha, as is befitting the kavod of Hashem. So what does that mean? Be'or devarav, the meaning of these words, she'im lo yilbash bigdei kavod, if the person decides not to wear his ordinary respectable clothes, yiyeh nir'eh she'u mitzta'er u'misabel al din shamayim, that he was mitzta'er, that he was suffering and he was in pain on the decree of heaven. Right? We have that, and we have it in Megillas Esther. When the decree was made, we have that Mordechai went out, bilvush sak va'efer. Mordechai went out in sackcloth and ashes to symbolize and to evoke from people the intensity of the doom that was to befall them, to invoke them to do teshuvah, to change the gezardin. O mishum kach be'emes yargish kein bilibo, v'lo yekablo ba'ava v'simcha. Because if a person changes their clothes into clothes of mourning or clothes that are beneath their stature, then within you lose that feeling of your stature, and you lose that feeling of ava and simcha to some degree, and then you're not able to accept the decree of Hashem. What does this have to do with Hanania, Mishael, and Azariah? How does it tie in? Shel lav shu es bigdei tefartan b'sha'ash en izraku letoch kivshan ha'esh. When Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were thrown into the fiery pit, they wore their royal garb. They didn't change their clothing. And it tells us, Kidei shelo yiru es atzmam mitzta'arim al gezeras hamakom. They didn't want to be perceived by themselves or by others as if they were angry at Hashem or they were upset at his decree. Bikablu osa be'ava uvesimcha. Rather, that they accepted the decree of Hashem with love and with simcha. And this was going into the pit assuming that they would die, right? They were thrown into the furnace. Most people, Avram made it out alive, but most people don't. Afilu tzadikim v'chasidim gedolim b'shas misasan. Even a tzadik, and even a righteous one, very righteous, very, very respected, at the time of their death, v'af b'sha'a she'im mosrim es nafsham al kiddush Hashem, even at the time when they're dedicating their life to Hashem, they're giving over their life, they're being moser nefesh for Hashem, they're about to die because they were Jews. Alulim lihiyos mushpa'im mimabu shehem. Even a person at the time of their death can be influenced by what they're wearing. So it's a powerful concept. Yes, the clothing, the clothing makes the man. What we wear does have an effect on us, right? And we know that when we go to work, we wear certain clothes. When we're home on a Sunday morning, we wear other clothes. And certain clothes which are respectable for certain places are not respectable for other places. And even if they're clothes which are not considered unrespectable, but it might not be suiting who we are, so we don't wear those kinds of clothes either because of who we want to be and the image that we want to be perceived as. Right? It's not saying, of course, that we're not supposed to judge another person by what they're wearing. We're talking about ourselves, like the standard that we set for ourselves. The Kohen Gadol, by wearing the big day zahav, by wearing the golden clothes, might have had a feeling of that. Now you think about it, like the Kohen Gadol is on a high level. He's doing the mightiest job on the mightiest day in the mightiest place. How much feeling would it be? How much? Like, ha, 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 ha. No. But on his level, it's a daki dakas, it's this minutest amount which could stem from gaiva that on his level would be already too much. If we had that feeling, it probably wouldn't be noticeable in us because we're not taken to that high standard, right? Tzadikim are our judge, kechot hasara. So any minute or here's with digression is considered a loss for them. So in order not to cause him to lose to even the tiniest degree from that level, we are extra careful.
The other time when clothing is mentioned before, and I'm wondering if it's anything to do with this, because I'm learning things are all related, was the cloak of many, the cloak that Yaakov gave to Yosef.
Right.
Is that referenced at all in this? Or?
So I think we mentioned it briefly on the previous page as an example of clothing, and important clothing. And that was and one of them was Yosef. So there was a lot of symbolism in Yosef's clothing.
But was symbolism in his clothing, but did it make him haughty? I mean, was that part of what made him haughty as well?
That was part of what set him apart from his brothers, and it caused the rivalry between him and his brothers. So there is a question amongst the Mefarshim if by giving him the Kesonas Pasim, that was the right thing to do. Right, and then again, that's a whole other discussion how we explain the rivalry. You know, like, what does that mean? You know, but again, I think just so we don't leave it totally hanging, it's the same concept that tzaddikim are judged with a fine hair comb, and whatever. When we use the word jealousy or rivalry, we're thinking of our common level pettiness, but it was more than that, right? It wasn't just common level pettiness. It was deeper than that. But on this like a tiny, minuscule level that for them was as large as it would be for us, and it was also for L'shem Shemaim. It was because of their yearning to be closer to Hashem, not because they just, you know, didn't get along for some insignificant reason, right? So what do we see here? Hayotze midvareinu hu. The lesson that we learn from these words, she'adam mushpa me'od mimalbushosav. A person is very influenced by what they wear. Afilu talmidei chachamim, tzadikim, v'chasidim, mushpa'im mimalbushehem, bein tov lahara. Everyone is influenced by what we wear, and we should all be careful in choosing the clothes that set the image that we want to portray of ourselves. And that is also, you know, the rationale sometimes behind uniforms for schools, right? You tell the kids, they go, what's the difference if I just wear, you know, I wear my t-shirt to school, but when you're wearing a t-shirt or when you're wearing, you know, a button-down shirt and you're sitting up a little bit straighter in your desk, you're showing a decorum for and an appreciation for what you're learning. You know, people say, oh, why do sometimes people wear, you know, white shirts and black pants? Why do, you know, like, again, it's just an image, it's just a persona of I want to show a certain dignity about myself and how I want to represent myself. And of course, there is, along that same vein, there is a danger of dressing in a certain way if we're not up to that way of dressing, because we might then feel like we're already at a certain level and we won't wish to strive to perfect ourselves. Which, you know, so we have to also take it, you know, take it. There are sometimes people that dress in a certain way because they want to be perceived as a certain way, not because they've necessarily reached that level, right? The certain...
Is that a fake it till you make it? Is that a bad thing?
For sometimes it's yes. For sometimes that could be a bad thing. You know, like if it's going to make you act in a more dignified way, then hey, fake it till you make it. But if you're wearing it because you want to think that you're already at that level, and you don't have to fake it, that you already made it, then it's not okay.
We want other people to think this.
That's for sure wrong, right? You want other people to think you made it, but you haven't. You know, that's why, you know, we, again, like we said, we can't judge people by what they're wearing, you know, for either way. You know, if they're dressed in a higher standard, a lower standard, you know, let's just seize the judgment either way.
Example, like a Rosh Hashiva will often wear like a longer
coat. A long coat, right.
And, you know, I guess lots of people wear hats, but, you know, there's a certain
kind of hat or a certain kind of coat that, you know, a person at, you know, at a certain position would wear,
right.
And if you're not at that position,
it's
like,
not
or
like a woman wearing a skirt who wears pants other times to make people think she's wearing a skirt.
No. I think like as a role model, you know what I'm saying? Like as a person who is trying to imitate a certain role model, but they're not in that same role.
Well, like somebody trying to dress up as the chief of police, you know, and they've just
been. Right.
You know, they've just been recruited to the force, but that's their aspiration.
Yeah, wasn't there somebody in the news that he had a uniform and he pretended that he was like
a veteran?
Was it a veteran, right? Yeah. And he had all these badges and stuff, and he was not.
Right.
You know,
right.
So you can't, you know, fake it till you make it. He didn't go through the system.
Right.
You know, he didn't earn it. You know.
Right.
So, okay. So I think that touches upon Aaron and his choshen and his clothes.
So what, I mean, just following the word for clothing is the same word as for deceit. Right.
Oh, interesting.
So, cool.
Right.
Because clothing, like on the one hand, it's betrayal of who you really are, but it could be who you really are.
Right.
Or it could be
right. You could betray yourself. I'm saying a person in a uniform or a person in a costume, right?
Right?
I mean, I don't want to say bad about other people, but I just read that there was a group of people that were arrested for drug smuggling. But they weren't suspected at first because of how they were dressed. And it was only, I forgot what suspicion prompted the police to search them further, but they normally, because they were dressed in a certain way, they were not, you know, they were not, you know, I guess racial they were not profiled as being what they are. So it could be a trade-off. You know, a person could dress a certain way to get away for something. A person could dress a certain way to, you know, be part of something. Either way. So it's like, that's what Rachel's saying. Beged is clothes, but boged is to be a traitor. Mm-hmm. And you could see also, we could compare, we could probably do a whole other unit about the clothes of Esav, when Yaakov put on the clothes of Esav to pretend he was Esav to get the bracha. Right, so that's another.
A person who goes to shul, they will usually wear pants, but for sure she wears a dress, skirt or dress.
So she's showing respect for where she's going.
Okay.
Right? So yeah, she's showing respect for where she's going.
So she's not pretending.
She's not pretending.
Okay.
No.
No. You dress nicely to go to a wedding, right? You know, like, if you usually wear jeans and a t-shirt, you wouldn't wear jeans and a t-shirt to the wedding.
So
right.
No, the same thing with covering her head,
right.
Going.
Yeah,
it
no.
sounded like she's pretending to be somebody she's not.
No, it's showing the right, you know, it's showing the right decorum for the right
for the
location.
Right
it would not be, you know, it would not be appropriate to show up at a wedding, you know, dressed in a certain way. And when you go here, you dress this way. When you go there, you go another way. Okay, so now let's tie in the Kohen Gadol and the Nazir in terms of Tamei Lames. Hopefully we have time to finish that. There's still more. Oh boy. Okay. All right, so let's look, if we go back to the beginning of our booklet, the page behind page 118, the back page of 118 is again from the Sefer HaChinuch. It says Parshas Naso on top, Reish Chaf. So we have a bullet on the bottom left corner, which is Mitzvah Shin Ayin Vav 376. Shelo yitamei hanazir bameis ubishar tumos. That a nazir should not become tamei, impure, ritually impure, from a person who's passed away. And this is the whole mitzvah. It has actually the same format as we discussed, right? It's going to have the same four paragraphs. It'll tell us about the mitzvah. It'll have the laws of the mitzvah. It will tell us the minhag, how it's actually acted upon, and then how it is in all of the time, how it's fulfilled. So the four paragraphs. So what we want to see is that it's actually a mitzvah. It's part of being a nazir. It's part of maintaining a certain status. He's going to stay away from wine. He's going to stay away from any wine ingredients, anything intoxicating. He's going to grow his hair. And he also can't do this. So this is the Sefer HaChinuch, which actually is going to go through all the laws of why he has to do it, when he does this, and who it applies to. We're not going to go through all of that right now. I just want you to see that their mitzvah is inside and that for you to have it. If you turn the page, then you will see Sefer HaChinuch page Kuf Mem Tes. It says Kuf Mem Tes on the top of the page. And we have a bullet on the bottom left column, which says Reish Samach Gimel 263, which is called Shelo Yitamei Kohen Hedyot Bameis Zulas Bakrovim Hamivoarim Bakasav. That a Kohen Hedyot, not the Kohen Gadol, the regular Kohanim, are not allowed to become Tamei Lames except for the people that are listed in the Pasuk. There are six relatives that he is allowed to become Tamei for. And then we're going to compare that to the next page, which is Kuf Nun, which is Mitzvah Reish Samach Dalid, Mitzvahs Inyan Tumas HaKohanim LeKrovehem, the Mitzvah of a Kohen to become Tamei for their relatives and to mourn for them. And that's Mitzvah 264. Okay, so we need to compare. It's that he's not allowed to become Tamei except for these people. We'll see who they are and why. And then on the flip side, it is a mitzvah that he has to. Okay, which is a fascinating thing in of itself. Okay, so let's go. We're on Kuf Mem Tes, the bottom bullet. Shelo yitame kohen hedyot bames, that an ordinary kohen should not become impure. Zulasi bekrovim hamivorim bakasuv, except for the people that are listed in the pasuk. Kol echad mekohanim lo yitame lanefesh mes, and it's giving you the words of the pasuk that he can't. Why? Paragraph 2. Mishar sheha mitzvah, the root of the mitzvah, lefi sheha kohanim nifcharu la'avodas Hashem baruch hu. The kohanim were chosen by Hashem to do His service. Kemo she'amar hakasav, like the Torah says, kedoshim yehiyu le'lokeichem, you should be holy to your God. Al kein hirchi kam min hames, therefore in order to be holy and to remain in a pure state, they have to stay far away from impurity of a death. Ukvar kasafti lemala. I already discussed this above. She'inyan hatuma davar nimas b'nelach. He already discusses what this concept of impurity is, and he is repeating it a little bit over here. But then it says, here we go. No heges mitzvah zu, the kuf mem tes. Sorry, I continue on the next page. I went the wrong way. Okay, we continue on the next page, which is kuf nun. That they cannot be tamei only to the people who come to them about going into the tents. We're going to skip down a little bit to the left column. No heges, the second to last paragraph after the last paragraph before the bullet. Beno heges mitzvah zu b'kohanim hazicharim b'chol makom u'b'chol zman. This mitzvah applies to kohanim who are males in every place in every time period. Avo lo b'nekevos, but not for females. Because the pasuk says, "And mar el ha-kohanim, speak to the kohanim, b'nei Aaron, the sons of Aaron." It doesn't say, it doesn't include the daughters. Okay, so here it's the mitzvah that they are not allowed. This is a negative command. Do not become tummy. Now here is an interesting thing. What does it say? The next mitzvah though is Sheyitamu ha-kohanim la-mesim ha-niskarim ba-Torah, that a kohen should become tummy to these aforementioned relatives, the six closest relatives that he has. Shenemar la-yitama, this is a mitzvah aseh, it's a positive command, to them you should become tummy. Shekein keba ha-perush olav, and it tells him, yes, it's a mitzvah. What? Why? Why does it say, yes, it's a mitzvah? Because you might think that if it's, you can, right? You're not allowed to become tamei except for these people. You might think that it's an option. If you want to, you are allowed to, but you don't have to. But the mitzvah is lo ratza l'tamei. If you think you don't want to become tamei, mitam'in oso ba'al karcho. We make him impure against his will. Person can't decide that he's going to be holier or he doesn't apply to this. If there's a person whose mother, father, sister, brother, son, or daughter, and he's a kohen, passes away, he's required to be tamei. And if the person is refusing, then he is brought to the place to become tamei. V'lulei shekiblanu michachmei haperush kein, hayisi savor lomar shiyerushus. Because had the Chachamim not come and told me this, I might have thought that it was reshus, it was permissible. It was something that is allowed. Im ratza, if he wants, mitamei, he gets tamei. Im lo ratza, if he doesn't want, eino mitamei, then he doesn't. And it brings an example. Maisa sheba bi Yosef HaKohen, the last line, Yosef HaKohen's wife died, and he tried to stay away from him, but they forced him to become tamei lemes. So it's giving an example. And again, it goes through the whole reason about why he needs to be tummy. So now, what though is the question? I'm just trying to remember where I have it. Ay, ay, ay. Sorry. Okay, I can't find it inside right now, so hopefully you'll trust me on this one, that the reason why the Kohanim are commanded to become tamei for these people that are close to them is because it tells us that the Torah is derecheha darchei noam. The Torah is pleasant and the Torah is true and would be asking too much of the Kohen to not be there at that time. So now then the question is, if the Kohen is required to be at the passing of his relative, because it would be too much to ask of him, what about then to a person who is going through a loss, and it would mean a lot to that person to have their leader there with them to comfort them? Why can't he be there then? It would probably be a very big comfort at that time to have that person there. We lost my mother earlier this year. I can't believe it was just Rosh Chodesh yesterday, so it's been 9 months since my mother passed away. I just can't believe that it's been that long or so short, whichever way you look at it. But as I mentioned before, my mother came from a family of Kohanim. So my uncle, her brother, came in for the funeral, and he sat Shiva with us for a day or two, and then he had to go back. He sat the rest of the Shiva in Chicago, where he's from. And of course he's my uncle, and it meant a lot for him to be there. And the fact, though, that he had to be outside the room, right? He was not there. There was like a little trailer or something set up, like a little Kohanim room for him, and also the rabbi of the shul that my father goes to is also a Kohen. And, you know, it was just for him to be there. You know, like even, you know, of course as a family member, being so close to us, it was a comfort for us that we were all together, and it meant so much to us that he was there. But even, let's say, you know, like for the rabbi of my father's shul to be there, like, it would make such a difference to know that the person is in with you at the time. Like, there, like, when the mace is before you, when they bring you into the room, and, you know, I had been to other funerals before, but it's something different when, you know, that...
Was your mother his sister?
His sister, but she was married.
Oh, she's married.
She's married, so then you can't become tummy for that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so it just... You know, that's the time when you want somebody with you, the time that you want somebody to comfort you. So here we go. So what's the difference? So let's look now at the English. It says Parshas Emor. Lo yitameh ba'al be'amov leheichalo. A leader amongst his people may not become defiled. The Kohen cannot become tameh lemeis. A worthy Jew has passed away, and his community gathers to perform the chesed shel emes, the final, lasting, you know, tribute that we can make to this person. It's called the chesed shel emes because it's a kindness that you're doing with absolutely no concept in your mind that one day this person will pay you back for it. You know, we could do kindness to people altruistically. We can be nice to a person. We can help them out. We can send over a meal. We could give them a ride. We can go grocery shopping or other things like that. But... you know, in our mind, we might feel like we're doing it because we care about it and we do it wholeheartedly. But sometimes in the back of our mind, no matter how small, might say, well, I'll help her. She'll help me. She helped me. I help her. You know, like, it'll come, what goes around comes around. But chesed shel emes, it's not coming around. That person is gone. It stopped. You're doing it for them purely for the sake of this is the right thing to do and this is the respect that you pay. Of accompanying the body to its final resting place. The Kohanim, however, they cannot take part. The reason, according to the Ramban and the Sparno, is explained in the Pasuk above. A Kohen is a leader of his people, and therefore it is improper for him to lower his status by defiling himself with the impurity of a dead body. Since the Kohen is a leader among his people, to understand and to teach, it is befitting that such a person conduct himself in a dignified and regal, I guess there's the clothes again, and regal manner so that his words will be accepted. However, for immediate relatives, he may, because their honor is his honor. So now, let's take the situation. We have the family. Family is in great pain, and certainly the presence of the Kohen would be a big comfort to them. Not only would it be a comfort for them, but it would be an honor for the deceased to have the Kohen participate at their funeral. Right? Sometimes we look at, you know, we'll go to a funeral and it'll be a small reception and we'll feel bad. You know, a person sometimes is, you know, an elderly person. They don't have that many people left in the world to accompany them as they go. And sometimes, you know, on a person who is more famous or more well known, there could be crowds and crowds and throngs of people. You know, in Israel, let's say for like funerals of these great rabbis, there could be thousands and thousands of people. I remember when I was in eighth grade, So that was in 1986. Wow. That was in 1986. I was in eighth grade. And that year, within, I think, a couple weeks of each other, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky and Rabbi Moshe Feinstein passed away, two of the greatest leaders of our times. And I'm trying to remember who was first. Was it Moshe was first? I don't remember which one was first. But I was in eighth grade. I went to school in Queens. And Rav Moshe's funeral was on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. It was just a subway ride away. And our principal felt that, you know, it would be appropriate for us to go and participate at this funeral, not necessarily because we would see anything, and he wasn't even sure if we would hear anything, but just to be able to accompany or to be part of the procession that is providing the Levaya, this funeral, for this great rabbi. And of course, it was, you know, a very symbolic time, and it was a very, you know, it was a very awesome time. It was, you know, very historical. It was like, you know, where were you on the day that, whatever, you know, so I still remember this. So we had to call our homes. We got permission from our parents to go with the principal, whoever wanted to go and whoever got permission to go with the principal. We left school. And we walked with him. I remember like leaving school, walking to the subway, going on the subway, and the subways were filled with Jews, lots more Jews than usual, all getting off at the same stop. I think it was Delancey Street, whatever is the Lower East Side, or East Broadway. And we get off, and as we're getting off, there was just like throngs of people, like going up the stairs from the subway system up to the main level and then up again onto the street level. I think once we got to street level, that's as far as we went. We couldn't walk any further because it was blocks and blocks and blocks. There were speakers set up to be able to hear the speeches. Frankly, I don't remember any of them. I couldn't even tell you clearly now if I heard anything or what I heard. But just what sticks with me as, you know, a 13-year-old was being part of thousands of people at this funeral and just being there to just witness like the last respects to somebody who was so admired and such, you know, so respected by, you know, every Jewish community. And we didn't even stay for that long. Like we went up to the top, we stayed for a while and went right back down. But it's something that stuck with me. So for a person of a certain stature to speak at a funeral, you know, like at my mother's funeral, my father spoke, my uncle spoke, you know, some of the Rosh Yeshiva, the yeshiva that my father learns in spoke, the rabbi of his shul spoke. So it gives honor to the person who passed away when honorable people talk about them and talk about the great things and what a wonderful life they led and what a role model they were. So that would be fabulous if the Kohen could have been inside and he could have been there. On the other hand, exactly how much dignity does the Kohen lose by becoming ritually impure? Like really? It takes away so much from him? Surely people would understand that the necessity of the Kohen to do this for this mitzvah. People would be okay with that. So you're at 100 standards and now you're at 99, 98. Is it visible to us even a 95? Like, you're still at you know, you're still practically at perfection. Yet the problem is that the impact of their perception of the Kohen's teaching due to a perceived lowering of his dignity would have been smaller. So they are now looking at the Kohen instead of as being completely unbelievable, because now he's impure, like there's to a tiny, minute, iota, docus, little bit, he's not as spiritual anymore, because he's not. When you're impure, you're not at the same level as spirituality. So therefore, there might be a lapse in the reception of his teaching to us, because we might think, maybe he's not so perfect after all.
When he does become impure for valid reasons, can't he become pure again?
Of course.
So then why is this different? I mean, obviously, okay, so for that minute he's doing a great mitzvah, he's doing chesed as well.
Right.
And then he can purify himself.
He can, but there's a time span. So in that time span, he's not as spiritual as he could be. So we're trying to maintain pretty much an equilibrium of spirituality.
Then this also gives him, he does not have the opportunity to perform certain mitzvot either.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So he's losing out by not being on a spiritual level. He's losing out because he can't perform certain tasks. And at the same time, it changes our perception of him because we know he's less spiritual right now. Right?
Yeah.
We're gonna talk more.
Logical,
yeah. We're gonna go a little bit more in depth. Maybe that will help you.
But I have a bigger problem.
Yeah.
My bigger problem is not that he loses spirituality for a short amount of time. The problem is that we have now put him in a position that is so high that he no longer is human, and we should never do that. The humanity of a Kohen, lady or anybody, mm-hmm. is always human next to God. I mean, like, you mm-hmm. put him so high now, mm-hmm. his spiritual level and his whatever level, that you're almost losing sight of who he might be. I'm afraid of that.
Yeah.
No. That high.
Yeah.
But isn't it because he's representing God and that's the role that he's performing for us? Just like we're supposed to honor our parents because they're, for us, they're, like, representing our relationship with Hashem on some level, so we honor our parents because they're transmitting that, so we honor our teachers, we honor the Kohen, and it's because of our honor for Hashem.
So I think this might all connect to, like, earlier. Because he is that Malach Hashem Tzavakos, because he's that representative of Hashem, he is put on a certain pedestal, right? He is held to a certain standard. Not that we're not making him human, because if we were not making him, if we were making him angelic or godly and not human, then he wouldn't be allowed to be even become Tamei for his own family.
Because there were instances in the Torah that Kohanim made mistakes.
100%.
There's instances in the Torah of Kohanim where
100%.
He frocked.
100%.
For lack of a better word,
yeah,
right?
100%. The Kohanim were human, but in order to balance their human tendencies and to help them maintain a spiritual level, there are guidelines that are set aside. Right? So he is human. We discussed it before. We said, he might feel proud because he's wearing gold. That's a very human feeling, right? A parent dies. That's devastating. That's a very human feeling, right? So we are respecting his human feelings, and we are acknowledging that he is a human, yet at the same time we're holding him to a higher standard. Not that we're making him godlike and that he's infallible.
Okay?
Okay. So now let's just to sum up. Yet in spite of the great significance of this mitzvah, the teeny negative effect that it would have on the Kohen's dignity insists that he has to stay apart. Why? Because the Torah is teaching us the paramount importance of Torah education and leadership. Any loss of the effectiveness of Torah leadership, ever so slight, is too great to bear. Like that slight loss that might happen could affect us for eternity. And they say that same example with a rocket ship. Right, the rocket ship has to travel so far in such a short amount of time. It's even off by an iota, then it's not reaching its destination. It's going to end up on the other side of the world or wherever it shoots it. So what happens? The person who is the Kohen has to be able, on nearly all the time, be able to give over Torah and teaching to the Jewish people at the highest level that he is capable of. And that's the goal, okay? That's the goal. It's a work in progress. It's a work in progress, right? So basically the fact is that if he were to lose a tiny iota of his spirituality, his ability to transmit is also impaired, and that's dangerous.
Who says that?
This is from the Chidush, the pinnacle of creation, and it's based on the Chidush HaLev, so it's based on the Rosh Hashiva. And that just shows us how we, as you know, leaders of our families, of our communities, also have to hold on to that ability to pass on to others and to, you know, treat ourselves as humans, but also recognize that our spirituality is important as well. I just want to correct or just clarify one thing that we said yesterday. I was talking about the Mishnah Berurah yesterday, and I said that the Chafetz Chaim wrote it, and then when I opened up the first page, I got distracted by all the names on the front page. Yes, it was the Chafetz Chaim that wrote it. He wrote it as a commentary and explanation on the Orach Chaim, which is the Shulchan Aruch written by Rabbi Yosef Cairo. So for the record, yes, it was the Chafetz Chaim that wrote it. Somehow, you know, his two main works, the Mishnah Berurah and the Sefer on Shmiras HaLashon. I did mention it, but I think that I might have erred in correcting myself or erroneously correcting myself by being that it was the wrong person because there were so many other names on the page. So I guess just to sum up in, I don't know, three sentences or less, the Kohen was there as a role model, a symbolism of good that can be showered down upon us from Hashem. The Kohen is the transmission, not that the Kohen is the one who is providing us with all the goodness, but he is rather the one that we could turn to increase our ways, to become better people, so that Hashem could shower down his blessing through us. And because of their lofty role, there are lofty expectations of them, taking into account that they are human, to try to help them maintain their humanity while at the same time losing their humanity, I guess, if you will. Thank you so much. This was so enlightening for me. Believe it or not, there's still another booklet or two. So if you want to hold on to them, maybe we'll get to them at another time. I was going to discuss also maybe a little bit more about Kohanim and the role of the Kohanim, so we could still do that. And also as a spin-off of Birchas Kohanim, the concept of Shalom, peace, and Chayin, grace.
Maybe you'll do that in your class.
So maybe I'll do that in my classes, maybe after Yom Tov. We'll finish it up. If you come, I'll do it. Okay. I would love to, probably after Yom Tov.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you hear what I said?
I didn't hear? Lean either, so then Lean either, I'll do it. Yeah, I can't commit to anything, but yeah. And even if you don't come every time, then we'll... Yeah. So there's more. Okay, have a great Shabbos, everybody.